Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show here on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the effort to better diagnose Valley Fever.
And delays and cancellations are racking up at Sky Harbor as the government shutdown continues.
But first, the State Department of Water Resources has taken the first step toward creating a new active management area, basically a part of the state in which groundwater is regulated. This is the second time ADWR has worked to do this. This new one is in La Paz County, while the first time was in Wilcox in southern Arizona. That action has proven to be controversial, though. With me now to walk through what all this means is Cameron Sanchez from KJZZ's Politics Desk. Good morning, Cameron.
Good morning.
So let's start off with what exactly is an active management area?
It's basically just a region where you pencil it off and say everything in here is protected and the groundwater is restricted in terms of how much you're allowed to pump.
So there are different rules basically in these areas, and they tend to be in more urban areas of the state, at least until somewhat recently.
Right. So this was all started with the Groundwater Management Act of 1980, and that established our first few AMAs, but they were in urban areas, like you mentioned, so Tucson, Phoenix, Prescott, and Pinal. And over the years, we've had a couple of others, but we haven't created many. And as you mentioned, it is a controversial process, and Hobbs is doing something kind of unique by her and her water agency creating more that's never happened before.
So do they actually have the authority to do that?
Well, there was some question about that. Republican lawmakers in particular were not really pleased with her doing this unilaterally rather than, for example, going to the legislature and coming up with some sort of bill and then working on it and passing it with bipartisan support. And there was also some complaining, I think, from the agricultural industry because agriculture is a huge water user, especially groundwater in a lot of these rural areas. And this is going to hit them hard.
Well, so I mentioned that the Wilcox AMA designation has been controversial. Is that basically the reason why, those reasons you just outlined?
Yes. I know lawmakers for the last couple of years have tried to come up with an alternative to AMAs, which would be specific to rural areas, like a rural management area plan. And everyone sort of agrees that that's a good idea, including the governor, but they have not been able to come to an agreement. So AMAs are basically the only tool in the toolbox, so to speak, in terms of regulating groundwater.
And it's probably worth mentioning that there is one community that voted to put itself in an AMA.
Right, Douglas. And Douglas and Wilcox actually voted on that at the same time for their respective basins. But Douglas was the only one that passed it. Wilcox voters said no. And then the governor came in, well, ADWR came in under her purview and was like, actually, we are going to do this because you guys really need it.
So what is what's the situation in this basin in La Paz County?
It's not great. The Department of Water Resources had studied a few groundwater basins to see how bad things were, and one of them was the Renegros Plain Basin in La Paz County out in western Arizona, and the levels have been dropping. There's an issue of land subsidence, which basically means when the water is being pumped up, the land starts to sink, which causes other problems. One of them is infrastructure. You know, it could damage roads. Another is that it's hard to ever recharge the aquifer again once the collapsing happens. So it's kind of permanently damaging the water basin there. And so the situation is essentially bad. ADWR has now started the process of considering making an AMA. It's not set in stone. They don't necessarily have to make an AMA. They could stop the process, but they've taken that first step.
So what are the next steps after that?
The next step is to have community meetings. They're going to have one in December. They've already had one sort of preliminary meeting with the community stakeholders, and they're going to be going back out there and continuing that process.
What are folks in La Paz County saying? I mean, is this proving to be as controversial in that community as the Wilcox Basin was?
I know at least some folks want it, but as you can imagine, it's a mixed bag. Some people are maybe uncomfortable with the idea of an AMA. They don't like the idea of their water use being restricted, understandably. But there are definitely a solid, you know, group of folks, including politicians, La Paz County Supervisor Holly Irwin, who say, no, we really need this. We need to do something. This is a serious situation. We'll take anything you can give us.
And agriculture is a pretty big deal in that part of the state also, right?
Right. And famously, that is the location of Fondamonte. Fondamonte is the Saudi Arabian company, and they farm alfalfa, which takes a lot of water. And they do actually farm in the Renegros Plain Basin, which we're talking about. And that has been the subject of a lot of controversy and even lawsuits.
Yep.
So I think that you know, that's going to maybe perk up people's ears and be like, ah, Fondamonte, restricting Fondamonte's water. That's important.
So you mentioned what the next steps are. Is there a timeline in terms of when we might know, yes, this basin will become an AMA or no, it won't?
Yeah, but it's going to be, I expect, in 2026.
Okay, so we have a little bit of time to worry about this.
Yes.
Okay, fair enough. That is Cameron Sanchez from KJZZ's Politics Desk. Cameron, thank you as always.
Thank you.
The State Department of Health Services reports more than 10,000 reported cases of valley fever so far this year. There were nearly 11,000 cases in 2023, the last year for which data are available. But research into treatment for the fungal disease continues, as does work on a vaccine to prevent it. Dr. John Galgiani is director of the Valley Fever Center for Excellence at the University of Arizona College of Medicine in Tucson. He joins me to talk about that research, as well as its future, with federal research dollars more uncertain now. And John, where are we right now in learning about this ailment and maybe how to prevent and treat it?
Well, the vaccine is probably the most exciting. We do many things, as you said. The vaccine is well along in its development towards a veterinary vaccine. We're working with Anavive Life Sciences, which is the company that licensed the discovery we made maybe 12 or 13 years ago. And they are a veterinary product company, and they have been working with us to take this discovery through what's called the Valley of Death, the really difficult part of taking something that might be good into something that is really useful. And they're on their way to probably have a vaccine approved by the USDA for dogs in veterinary clinics for use within a year.
Hmm. And at what point then, like how much clinical research and trials do you have to go through before you get the kind of data you need to get to see if this is going to be effective in humans?
Yes. Yeah, so the vaccine for humans is approved through the FDA. Whereas the veterinary vaccine goes through USDA, and all of the information in the USDA file becomes available to FDA. But frankly, it is primarily preclinical data. It becomes efficacy in a different species. But really, other than that, you pretty much start over. You need a new manufacturing process, and then you have to do additional safety tests, and then you start doing clinical trials.
Well, so when you talk about vaccines and needing to go through the FDA, I mean, I kind of feel compelled to ask about the current situation we're in terms of some changes with vaccines, not for valley fever, but for other vaccines. Does it make you nervous maybe that the current environment, the current administration might be less receptive, for example, to a valley fever vaccine than others?
I think it's very much worthwhile reading the newspapers about what's going on around the country. But that said, this disease, valley fever, is considered an equal opportunity disease. It's been supported by Republicans. It's been supported by Democrats. And no, it doesn't really – and I think people are interested in it regardless of the overall thought about vaccines. And this vaccine is sort of interesting in that it's not for a contagious disease. So in fact – there's no compelling reason to get the vaccine other than if you think you want to be protected.
And probably if you live in a place where you might be more susceptible to getting valley fever, right?
That's right. Absolutely. It's of no value if you live in Alaska where, right. In fact, turns out there are no valley fever cases, at least endemically. But if you live here where two-thirds of all U.S. infections come from Arizona, then the risk is about 4% per year of getting infected. And if you're of a mind that a vaccine makes sense, then it'd be wonderful to have the vaccine. If you don't have the vaccine, you don't have that option. Whereas people who really don't want to take the vaccine, there's no compelling public health reason for you to do it other than for your own personal health.
Is your research or the research of some of the folks with whom you work affected at all by reduced grant funding from the federal government, from the NIH?
So the original work we did was on a grant several years ago, which is where we showed that the vaccine was very effective in preventing valley fever in dogs. And since then, last year, the company I mentioned, Anavive, got a contract from NIH to take the vaccine from where we are now into the first human trial. And so far, that contract has been going through. We've been continuing to work under that.
Are you concerned that that contract might be canceled at some point?
Well, I'm concerned that that would be a problem. It did. But at the moment, it hasn't been. And we think there's really no reason it should be. And I think there's support for the work to be done.
I'm curious about just sort of the general work that the center is able to do. It sounds as like maybe some of the support, some of the infrastructure might also have been affected or might be affected by some of the changes coming from D.C.
Well, that's a complicated question. The infrastructure at the University of Arizona is whatever. And I actually have very little to know about that.
Sure.
But our offices are open and we continue to do our work. The work that is being done on the contract is not – at least we are subcontractors on that contract to Anavive. But at this point, it has not really been affected. And I've gotten support. In fact, the center itself has been primarily supported on philanthropic support. And then the other thing that we are really interested in doing is not so much bench research, which we do quite a bit of, but also to get – people aware of this disease. And I've this year actually completely came to the obvious conclusion after I realized that it was pretty obvious that awareness is where it all starts. If you don't know about a problem, you're not going to worry about it. And it turns out with Valley Fever, if you know about Valley Fever before you get sick, and this is Arizona Department of Health Services data, you're going to get a diagnosis sooner than if you don't know about Valley Fever because people ask, don't you think you should test me? And it turns out that's a very important question because many physicians don't remember to test for Valley Fever even when they should. And so we're really working on that. And then if you don't get the diagnosis and you're sick with Valley Fever, you're being treated for all sorts of things you don't have, none of which helps you. And so once you get a diagnosis, then you get precise care for the diagnosis you have. And the final thing is once you know there's a problem here, you start asking, wait a minute, why are the diagnostics so slow to get results back? And it turns out it would be really nice if we had a point of care test. And these drugs don't cure this disease. They help, mm-hmm. but they don't cure it. So why don't we have a cure for this disease yet? And I heard about a vaccine that was invented at the U of A. We really should promote. So, awareness leads not only to better health for the individual, but I think it also leads to the basis for doing support for a disease that's very important to the state's economy, not just public health. But managing this problem is really, really important.
Well, it sounds like what you're saying is awareness is important both for patients and healthcare providers, but also for policymakers so that they continue to support the kind of research that leads to better outcomes.
I think that's absolutely right. And not only policymakers, but I think there are constituent stakeholders. I think professional sports, for example, real estate, if you want to attract new industry to the state, I think you need to manage this problem. And there was a magazine report in Money, Inc. in February 2024 where they talked about if you're thinking about relocating to Arizona, there are a few things you should know about just before you make that decision, 9 things they went through.
Hmm.
Number one problem that they identified was Valley Fever.
Really?
Now, I think that's misguided. I don't think – the more you know about Valley Fever, the less anxiety-producing it is. But it is a management issue, and I think not only for managing the message but also actually doing the best we can. And if you have a managing program, it's better than pretending it doesn't exist.
All right. That is Dr. John Galgiani, director of the Valley Fever Center for Excellence at the University of Arizona College of Medicine. John, good to see you again. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how one of Scottsdale's iconic public arts events has evolved over the last 17 years.
But first, Pam Lack is digital humanities librarian at UC San Diego. And this week, she's coming to ASU to give a talk called The Stories We Still Need, Podcasting for Urgent Times. Here at the show, we've done several stories over the last year about the pervasive influence of chat show podcasts on politics. With the medium becoming so ubiquitous, podcasting often seems less urgent than ever before. So when we saw the title of Pam's talk, it felt like a somewhat provocative idea. Lack says she got the inspiration for her talk from some experiences she had back in 2020 and 2021. She was working with the National Humanities Center on a series of week-long podcasting workshops geared toward doctoral students. The timing of the workshops overlapped with a series of disruptive events in American culture: the COVID-19 quarantines, the murder of George Floyd, and the January 6th insurrection. As Lack told our co-host Sam Dingman, when the workshop participants sent in their podcasts, she noticed that many of them were telling personal stories connected to those events.
And those were the most moving for me because it was participants grappling with a series of issues related to what it meant to go into isolation, how that impacted our experience of time and intimacy. Many of our groups grappled with structural and systemic racism and police violence. And then as we progressed into January 2021, a lot of those podcasts were trying to make sense of the insurrection, continuing to make sense of loneliness. We had a podcast about grief with a member who had recently lost her partner. These were powerful, gut-wrenching, raw, vulnerable podcasts.
And am I hearing you right, Pam, that these were folks who were willing to share their own personal experience or personal perspective on a larger story? It was their own life that was informing their storytelling.
Absolutely. And of course, not everybody took it to that personal level, but so many participants did. And that's what was so powerful. It was that they were willing to share a little bit of themselves with a group of strangers. My colleagues and I who ran the institutes, we really tried to engineer that through a set of guided conversations and a set of shared readings. We had them read Adrienne Marie Brown's Emergent Strategy, Shaping Change, Changing Worlds. And we asked students to use that approach of scaling down, aiming for smaller, working from a place of trust, and for being more present and not so worried about perfection.
Yeah.
And in particular, this one principle, there is a conversation in the room that only these people at this moment can have. That, I think, drove a lot of our participants to search within themselves.
You know, I have to say, Pam, I'm so compelled by this idea because in my mind, and please tell me if you disagree, so much of what characterizes the current political moment, and this felt true at the moments from just a few years ago that you're describing as well, is the velocity at which things are happening, the speed at which various kinds of media, whether it's cable news or social media, come at you with information that feels unprecedented and also very emotionally, like, tragic. And there is a tendency in storytelling about moments like that to try to go big, to try to get your arms around everything. And what you're describing is the inverse of that, if I'm hearing you correctly.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. We really embraced the emergent strategy principle: small is good, small is all. The large is a reflection of the small. And by that, we really encouraged that sort of scaling down and slowing down as a way to filter through all the noise.
Do you think there is something about podcasting as a medium that makes it uniquely suited to this kind of small bore, intimate, emotionally, personally grounded type of storytelling?
I think it is absolutely suited for that type of storytelling for a couple of reasons. It is, at its heart, a very DIY medium. It doesn't require a lot of fancy equipment, although certainly you can spend a lot of money on podcasting equipment. You can create a makeshift studio wherever you are, and you can publish it for free and push it out to people through a free RSS feed. And what was really interesting to see in the pandemic was a real uptick in podcasting, both creation and listening. Even though people weren't commuting to work, which is often one of the big ways they engage with podcasts, but it was about human connection.
Yeah.
Most people listen with headphones, so the sound is actually coming into your body. It's incredibly intimate.
Yeah.
And I suspect that that's what's happening right now. We're all siloed from each other. Social media has completely splintered. It's full of harmful content. And through all of that, we're desperately seeking for authentic human connection.
Yeah. But can I ask you, Pam, you're obviously an evangelist for podcasting. I came to radio from the world of podcasting. It's a medium that is very dear to me. But I'm curious to get your take on the state of things, because as I know you know, the definition of what podcasts are has changed so much mm-hmm. in recent years, particularly mm-hmm. with the increased emphasis on them becoming a visual medium, mm-hmm. which changes so much of all of the lovely elements of podcasting that you were just rhapsodizing about. And I think, you know, we've had conversations on this show before about the ways that podcasts have become symptomatic of the harmful content that we get on social media. They've become ways of spreading misinformation, platforming mm-hmm. nefarious political actors without challenging them on their beliefs or the claims that they're making. Do you worry about the sustainability of the version of podcasting that you care about so deeply?
That's such a lovely question. And I will say it's funny that you have this impression of me as an evangelist for podcasting. I am and I'm not. I think that whenever somebody approaches me and says that they want to launch a podcast, I always ask them why. Like, how will that podcast reflect their values? And if they can't give me a good answer, I'll gently suggest that maybe they're not ready to launch a podcast. The people who tell me, I just want to do it because it'll be cool, or I'm trying to, you know, spread my, I'm trying to reach more markets or build my audience. I'm less interested in that kind of podcasting. As long as people can still publish an audio file online and push it out through an RSS feed, we can still have these kinds of podcasts that can move us to change.
Well, you know, it strikes me, Pam, that you're asking people who say to you that they want to start a podcast a really important but also provocative question, this idea of like, great, how does that reflect your values? I mean, that's a question that could stop somebody in their tracks, you know?
And it has. I start everybody there whenever someone has an idea, whether it's a digital project or an assignment that they want to introduce in their class or a podcast. If they don't understand what the thing they're going to invest a lot of time and labor into, like how that aligns with who they are and the kind of work they're doing, then it's just noise, I think.
Well, Pam Lack is a digital humanities librarian at San Diego State University, and she'll be at ASU this Wednesday, November 12th, to give a talk called The Stories We Still Need, Podcasting for Urgent Times. Pam, thank you for this conversation.
You're welcome. It's been such a pleasure.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Some Senate Democrats broke with their party over the weekend, striking a deal with Republicans to reopen the government with the promise of a future vote on health care, which they've been holding out for. The group of eight Democratic defectors does not include Arizona's two senators, Mark Kelly and Ruben Gallego. The deal still faces several hurdles before it can be passed, but right now it looks like the end of the longest government shutdown in U.S. history could be near. Because of the government shutdown, flights are being canceled and delayed all over the country. The shutdown has hit air traffic controllers especially hard. So hard, in fact, that the Federal Aviation Administration announced last week it would cut 10% of flights at the nation's 40 busiest airports to reduce pressure on them. Sky Harbor International is one of those 40 airports, and the number of canceled and delayed flights there has gone up this morning. At last check, it's at 97 canceled flights, 403 delayed flights. And all of this has our next guest this morning angry, and he's already dubbed the cranky flyer. Brett Snyder runs a blog by the same name, and he joins us now to talk more about all of this. Hi there, Brett.
Hi, good morning, Lauren.
Okay, so the FAA made this announcement last week, and we've seen delayed, canceled flights kind of racking up all around the country. What's it look like now? Like, how bad's it gotten?
Well, we're not even fully ramped up at this point. It only started on Friday, and they're still technically at the 4% number, and it's supposed to go up to 10%. Hopefully that'll change if the government ends up reopening, though.
So the delayed flights, the canceled flights we're seeing now is only just a chunk of this 10% cut that the FAA ordered.
Yeah, for the cancellations. They gave them a period of time to try and ramp up to it. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem is that we've seen very significant problems with staffing in air traffic centers all across the country. So there have been additional cancellations and issues on any given day, depending upon who's available to do the job.
Yeah. So let's talk more about that, because there's a real problem when it comes to air traffic controllers. And there kind of was a problem before the shutdown even began, right?
Yeah, that's right. There's been a shortage for some time. Air traffic controllers have a mandatory retirement age. It's lower than most because it's a very difficult job. And so you have controllers that are reaching retirement age, and there hasn't been enough in the pipeline to replace all those.
Mm. So they're tired. They haven't been paid fully or at all in the last several pay cycles. I mean, like, problems with air traffic controllers, Brett, like, can lead to real safety issues, right? This is important, as you're getting at there.
Well, they could lead to safety issues. You know, I think the idea here is that the system is built in a way that if there aren't enough controllers, then it just requires canceling flights and to avoid those safety issues. But what I think this order did from the FAA is that it was a very broad order, very different than in specific instances. I know in Phoenix, there were some staffing shortages before this order came out, and there were significant cancellations and delays to deal with that. But this is, I guess, an attempt to be more proactive by pre-canceling all these flights. Mm-hmm. I don't know that it's actually going to have that helpful impact.
Right. So let's talk about your take on this. You it sounds like, take issue with how this 10% cut was rolled out and sort of who it's going to impact most.
Yeah, I find it actually fairly strange. They took 33 of the top 40 airports for scheduled flights. Then they took six airports that are big cargo hubs and one for private jets, Teterboro, outside New York. Mm-hmm. And it's rather strange to me, certain airports that got left out, like Nashville, for example, which yesterday had a 63-minute delay due to staffing shortages. So I don't know why one was left out and others were not. But the problem is that you just don't know. You know, these controllers, as you said, very stressed, overworked. You don't know on any given day who is going to call out and who will show up. And so I think there are a lot of flights that have been canceled that probably didn't need to be. And then there are other airports that have more severe issues where they need to cancel more.
Yeah. What about the airlines, Brett? Like, how hard is all of this hitting them, especially as they're ordered to make cuts?
Oh, this has been a real challenge for them. The final order on the cancellations from the FAA didn't even come out until Thursday evening, and it had to be implemented by Friday morning. Airlines are very complex networks. They have aircraft that need to be routed properly. They need to end up in maintenance bases to get the correct work done. They need to schedule other crews to be in the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
These don't happen that quickly usually. And so they've been scrambling and working very hard to make this come together.
And because of that kind of intricate system you're describing there, like, this has massive ripple effects, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, on top of that, there was snow in the upper Midwest over the weekend, and there's some rain elsewhere. So they're already dealing with the regular, irregular operations, as they call them.
Yeah.
And then to have this on top of that, it just makes this incredible puzzle. So, you know, go thank your fellow airline employees if you see them out there.
So let me ask you lastly here, Brett. I mean, it looks like this morning lawmakers might have reached a deal to maybe reopen the government at some point here in the near future. But, I mean, is it damage done?
Well, we don't really know how long it'll take to unwind from this.
Yeah.
The FAA had said it should be a 7-day period in advance that you have to file your schedules. So I think the hope at this point is that maybe they'll be able to get back to normal for the busy Thanksgiving period. But I think everyone has to remember that all this does is buy time until the end of January. And then the FAA is not part of this deal to get funded beyond that. So we could be in the same exact place in a couple of months.
So is that what you're watching for going forward as you kind of see the impact of Washington on this industry?
Yeah, this is just a very frustrating situation for everyone that works at airlines, for travelers, just for the economy, for anyone that needs to get where they need to go. And it continues to be left in the balance as politics plays out.
All right. Brett Snyder runs the blog, The Cranky Flyer, joining us to talk more about this. Brett, thank you as always for coming on. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
The Conference of the Parties, or COP Conference, gets underway in earnest today. It's a big worldwide conference on the climate. With me for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones in London. And Rob, we talked about this a bit last week, but how high should expectations be around this year's version, which is taking place in Brazil?
That's right. And I don't think our expectations should be set too high. There was an interesting article on the BBC earlier today that showed the family photograph, if you like, of all the different leaders who gathered at the Paris COP summit 10 years ago in 2015. And the interesting thing about that was that that photograph was very full. There were lots and lots of leaders there. And in fact, the photographer had trouble getting all of the leaders into that photograph. There were that many people at that conference, and it had lots of high hopes. If you remember, they set that target of 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, and the countries at that conference committed to trying to keep global warming of our planet, below that figure. And so there was a feeling of hope 10 years ago in Paris. Well, if you look at Brazil, Belém in Brazil this week, and particularly today, I don't think hope is the first word that you would use. There are far fewer leaders there, something like 30. Previous summits, there have been many more than that. Of course, we're not seeing Donald Trump there. So America is basically not represented really at COP30. The Chinese leader is not there, although it should be said some 300 Chinese delegates are there, which is more than was expected. And of course, China has quite a good story to tell because it's been on the front foot in terms of things like renewables and so on. The leader of India, the world's most populous country, well, he's not there. So you can see that there is a sort of weakened COP30 going on this year, even though it's in or on the edge of the Amazon rainforest, which, of course, is so tokenistic in terms of preserving the Amazon and tackling climate change and it being so important in that fight. So the bottom line is it's looking quite weak. President Lula of Brazil and others are sounding defiant. And in fact, he's launched a big campaign to try and pull together as much money as possible to help protect the Amazon. And so that might be an interesting agreement at the end of it. But at the moment, it's looking like a shadow, shall we say, of some previous COPs.
Interesting. All right, Rob, let's move now to Iran, which is a country of some 90 million people, and it is suffering from a prolonged drought. In some places, it's even now having to begin water rationing, in some cases worse. What is going on there?
Yeah, this is an interesting one. We don't often talk about Iran and environment, but they've got a big problem at the moment. They've got a severe drought that's been going on for a long, long time, and now it's having a really big effect. So Iran's second largest city, which is called Mashhad, which is in the northeast of the country, they need to manage their water use. So reservoirs supplying that city have fallen below 3%, some of them, capacity. That city is a city of 4 million people, and they are really having to be careful about their water usage. On Saturday, we had water rationing announced for the capital of Iran, Tehran, which is also in the north of the country. Officials said water supplies in that city would be cut during certain times of the day, that five major dams supplying drinking water are at, quote, critical levels, with one of them actually empty. And earlier last week, we even had the president of Iran, Masoud Pezeshkian, warning that the capital, Tehran, might have to be evacuated if shortages continue. So this is a big deal, obviously. It ties in quite well with COP, actually, and global warming and kind of arid conditions, especially in areas like the wider Middle East. But they are having a big water shortage there. They're having a massive drought, and it's affecting their main cities, and they are having to bring in this rationing and hoping for rain.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Rob, this week, a Syria's leader will be in Washington, D.C. to meet with President Trump. And for a lot of reasons, this seems like maybe a surprising development.
It is, because this man was, let's just put it this way, he fought for al-Qaeda in Iraq. He was arrested and detained and imprisoned by the Americans in that time. And at one point, he had a $10 million U.S. dollar bounty on his head. Now, how remarkable then that a man, a former jihadi, should be entering the White House this week, an extraordinary turn of events. And that's because he severed ties with al-Qaeda some time ago, a number of years ago. And he was the guy leading a group in Syria who essentially were the main group that managed to get rid of Bashar al-Assad, the former dictator in Syria. That happened in December last year. And of course, he had been in charge, and his father before him, a dynasty, for decades in Syria. He defined Syria. So this guy came along, got rid of him. And then in order to attract investment into Syria and try and stabilize that country, he agreed internationally that he would try and be a moderate leader and bring together people rather than keep them apart. Now, there have been some issues in his country where different tribes and ethnic groups have attacked each other, especially the Alawites, who was the group that was in charge in December and before. But he appears to be doing what he can. And one reason he's in D.C. is because he wants America to carry on raising sanctions on his country, sanctions that were imposed in the previous period, but he's trying to get rid of them. So it's a really interesting turn of events that he should now be in the White House.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that meeting goes. All right, that is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones in London. Rob, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. It was a big weekend in Old Town Scottsdale, where the Dreamy Draw Music Festival drew thousands. And one of Scottsdale's signature arts events, Canal Convergence, kicked off on the waterfront. Canal Convergence goes for 10 nights through the next weekend, featuring art installations full of lights, flames, interactivity, and even a giant old-fashioned TV this year. It's an event that's been going on since 2008, when Scottsdale Arts held its first event at the canal, then dubbed Night Lights. Back then, our next guest tells us it was very grassroots. But today, it's seen as a trailblazer in public art. Wendy Reisinen is the curator of collections and exhibitions for Scottsdale Public Art, and she was there when it all began. I spoke with her more about it.
You know, it was right after the 2008 crash, and the city of Scottsdale wanted us to, you know, somehow activate the canal banks near the towers, as they call them. And the south side of the canal wasn't developed at all. So we were mostly just figuring out a way to do something fun there. We got local artists, sculptors from community colleges, from Tucson, and even some of our staff had gone to Burning Man and found somebody to come. So it was very grassroots. We were just like drawing with colored lights and a long exposure camera and making, somebody made a sculpture with lights and clear tape, like a mm-hmm. body. And it was just like real small and kind of low tech compared to what's going on now.
Compared to what's going on now, yeah. For sure. The technology has changed. It was called like Night Lights or Get Lit, something like that.
Yeah, it was called Night Lights on the Canal, but we had these shirts that said Get Lit with Scottsdale. So it was a little like racy, but we thought it was hilarious.
Yeah, and playing with artwork in that way, which is, it was kind of new to do something like that at the time. Not just the lights, right, which have become so big in art right now, but the idea of doing something interactive.
right, interactive. You know, I'm finding that even then, the digital world, the engagement world is all on your computer, and the value of engaging with human beings mm-hmm. and exchanging energy with them and just like facial expressions and, you know, just like, let's play. It just feels fun. And it's definitely, I feel like, still obviously something everybody needs to experience.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the evolution of this, because if you're talking about what this looked like in the grassroots origins of this, you know, more than a decade ago, it looks very different today. This is a big event on the canal there in Old Town Scottsdale. Tons of people come out. You bring in artists from all over the world.
Yeah.
How did it get this big?
Well, we just we got more support and budget from the City of Scottsdale mm-hmm. and the Visitors Bureau, and they wanted to turn it into a 10-day event rather than just a weekend. And so we were able to bring in all these artists. I was like really excited about, very proud to be able to say, and these artists are from Russia or from Europe, or, you know, it was just like, yeah, we're here doing this really amazing thing, and other people in the world want to get involved.
Yeah.
And here's like, it's for you, you know, it's for everybody.
Yeah. Tell us about some of your favorites over the years. Like, are there installations, exhibits that have been part of Canal Convergence that really stand out to you?
Yeah, several. I mean, over the years, there's so many. One of my favorites, and I still get people who ask me about, you know, could we get those guys back who had the floating fish in the air that were lit up and they were dancing? It was just, they were amazing. They were these translucent fabric fish filled with helium, and they had these dancers who had them like on poles, and it was just magical. It was like you were underwater, but these floating fish were happening. And then, let's see, we had another few years ago, Masari Studios brought in these light-up plastic cubes that everybody could play with on the bridge, like stack them and make bridges and make piles, and they would light up with music.
Yeah.
And the kids loved them. Everybody loves this stuff.
There's also always like a pyrotechnics thing nowadays, right? Like there's something on the canal that's burning.
Yeah. The Walter Studios folks, who are local, they always do a fire show. And that is one of the most popular things. When I'm at the info booth, 9 times out of 10, that's the question. When's the fire show?
Yeah. So I think one of the things that's really interesting about looking at Canal Convergence, you know, from a big picture lens, is how many of these ideas that you started with, whether it's, you know, doing interactive art or light centric art, or even just like art that people can take a selfie in front of, which is such a thing now. Those ideas are all everywhere now. Do you feel like you guys were on the cutting edge?
I really do. The reason is that when we started out early on, in even getting like the bigger artists and the international artists, it was exciting and they were excited. We could easily afford these artists. And now that this type of art and light show is happening all over the world, yeah. I mean, they have them everywhere, they can charge more money. And it's like, oh, well, we started you out, man. Can you give us a little break here? But they're more expensive.
A little bit of a catch 22 there,
yeah.
But that's interesting. It sounds like you've inspired a lot of events like this in other cities. People call you and say, how do you do this? How do we start?
Yeah, we've had sort of city leaders from various places. One in particular, Breckenridge, Colorado, came out a few years ago, and they came to the event.
Mm-hmm.
And that's usually what happens. They'll come out and experience it and meet the artists. And then, you know, the following year, they're doing their own. Yeah.
It's cool. I wonder, you said something earlier that I want to hit on again, because I think it's really key here, especially in our kind of technology-centric world. You talked about just bringing people together mm-hmm. in a physical place, right? And doing something physical, like interacting with the art with your hands, which doesn't happen as much today, I feel mm-hmm. like. Why do you think that's important?
We're human beings. We're a social creature. We need it. I just feel like it's a biological need. It's not something you can escape.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of being human.
Yeah. It's interesting because, like, when you think of art today especially, like, it's rare, I think, that the conversation is not political or, like, divisive. Mm. So much of our rhetoric is about that. And so much of, I think, what art does is comment on that kind of dialogue, that discourse, mm-hmm. which I think has hit Scottsdale as well. Do you feel like you can do that today? You can have an art show that is sort of only bringing people together?
I think that's what we're trying to do. There's plenty of opportunity for biting commentary on the state of our world in art. But the fact that what we want to do is to bring people together, we sort of try and keep it in that lane.
Mm-hmm. So you're kind of trying to stay away from the political in this realm, at least.
Yeah, I think we do.
Is there pressure in the art world in general right now? And you're an artist yourself, we should say, like, to, I guess, comply to sort of either stay away from those things or downplay DEI type things because of the administration we're under?
Well, that is a fantastic question. I think it just depends on where an artist is in their career and who's funding them. But as far as censoring and stuff, we really try not to be affected by that.
Yeah.
It's a bad slope to be heading down, I think.
Right.
I feel like this type of experience could be a point of coming together and healing.
Okay. We'll leave it there. That is Wendy Reisinen, curator of collections and exhibitions for Scottsdale Public Art, joining us. Wendy, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And finally today, we wanted to say congratulations to a show favorite, someone we've had on the program a few times over the years, local nerdcore rapper Megaran. Here he is at our live event at the Crescent Ballroom in September.
I'm ready for anything because I used to teach middle school, y'all. And I've definitely learned if you can do that, this is easy.
On Friday, Megaran was nominated for a 2026 Grammy for his album Buddy's Magic Treehouse in the Best Children's Music Album category. Here he is again performing a song from that album, The Library, John.
Okay, I want to talk to you about my favorite place in the world, the library. Any readers here? Excellent! So again, I wrote this for my kids. We were trying to learn how to spell it. So let's go like this. L-I-B-R-A-R-Y. Come on, L.
Yeah, I can go deep underground. I can fly through the sky.
The 2026 Grammy Awards will be held on Sunday, February 1st, 2026.
Help me out.
Quest for enlightenment, the journey starts here. So much beauty from the front to the rear. When you're chilling at the L-I-B-R-A-R-Y.
One more time.
L-I-B-R-A-R-Y.
Hey, sometimes I want to read, sometimes I want peace. Well, there's one place I can go to get a little bit of each.
No better way to end a program than by listening to Megaran, right?
I totally agree, but I have to say I listen to this song a lot because my kids really like it. So
you can do a lot worse.
I know how to spell library really well.
That is, I'm sure that is helpful in your day-to-day life as well, right?
Every day.
All right. Well, thank you, as always, for being along on this Monday edition of the show. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a great rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
Come on.
And if you're on a quest for enlightenment, the journey starts here. So much duty from the front to the rear. You chilling at the L. Well, let's have the L.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.